Our next speaker is Professor Jessica Lundquist in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, and she'll be talking to us about trees and snow in Seattle's Cedar River watershed. That's Jessica.
Can we dim the lights a little bit? I think the pictures will show better. Great. And I want to acknowledge my co-authors, Jenna Forsyth and Nick Wayand, are both grad students working with me. Jim Lutz is a postdoc research associate in the Department of Forest Resources. And Rolf and what we're looking at is, can you manipulate on the ground? Design and very preliminary results. As I said, we have no snow right now. All right, starting with the history of the watershed. Back in 1914, following the big fire downtown Seattle, they decided they needed a reliable source of water for Seattle and constructed the Masonry Dam on the Cedar River watershed. These photographs are just a few of many available from the Seattle Municipal Archives photograph collection. And what they did, they built this this dam, and you can actually go on tours. It's really interesting to see. There now are stalactites coming down from the top of the concrete. And how many people have been to Rattlesnake Lake up by North Bend? If you notice, there's a lot of tree trunks down on Rattlesnake Lake, and it turns out that it wasn't always a lake. Back in the 1900s, here's a picture of the town of Montcalm. There's a train depot, and 1915, right when they started filling that reservoir, all of a sudden it turns out that you add some head to the river up there, and the hydraulic pressure is connected to this valley, and we got Rattlesnake Lake. So what actually limits the amount of storage in the Cedar River is the fact that there are very loosely compacted sediments next to their high hydraulic conductivity, and they can't raise the head. So they have very limited storage due to the fact that the water isn't going to even stay in their watershed. Some of it ends up going down to Snoqualmie. So it rains a lot up there. We have enough water. The average annual outflow is 75,000 million gallons per year. And the annual water demand, which is met for the city of Seattle by both the Cedar and the Tolt reservoirs, is about 50,800. However, the reservoir capacity is very small. This is a reservoir that fills and empties multiple times per year. In addition to trying to meet the demand for the city, they're also trying to take care of the ecosystem. Probably the token species is the endangered bull trout, which requires water temperatures generally below 55 degrees Fahrenheit that is prevalent in the watershed. So, essentially, it's hard to store water is the main issue. You don't need more total water, but you want the water more at a time of year where you can use it. So, let's move on to climate change, which you probably heard a bit about this morning. The first thing, just for overview, the biggest difference from climate change is whether you get rain versus snow. And this is a picture from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers 1956 Snow Hydrology Report, where they basically sat up at Donner Summit in California for about 10 years and marked down the temperature and whether it was raining or snowing every single day. And you can see that below 0 degrees C, we get snow. Above 3 degrees C, we get rain. And in between, we might get rain, we might get snow, or we might get, in between these two lines, is sort of mixed rain and snow. And this is what the Seattle City Times will call a wintry mix, and that's when you know you don't want to bike to work. That was the first thing I learned when I moved up here. All right, so Here's a map. Here's Seattle. Here's the Cedar River watershed. Here's the graphic of elevation. And so, you know, what's going on with that rain snow line within this watershed? So this is Puyallup sounding data. This is just off the coast. It's basically a weather balloon they send up and takes the temperature as the balloon goes up. And Justin Minder in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences put together, this is a histogram of the frequency of occurrence of the 0 degree level during storms. And so these are the storms that hit our watershed, and the median value in winter months is about 1,200 meters. So how does that compare to the Cedar River watershed? So here's elevation on the left axis, and fraction of total area contributing to runoff, where one means that if something's over 1,400 meters, everything's rain, the entire watershed's contributing to runoff. Here's the mean 3 degree sea level, and here's the mean 0 degree sea level. So what that basically means is that in the median, about 10% is all snow. About 50% of the watershed is wintry mix. We've been doing a lot of field work up there. It's really fun. And 40% is rain contributing to winter runoff. Of course, the thing to keep in mind is that this is a distribution. We still have days where it's snowing over the entire watershed. It's snowing in the city of Seattle, such as the winter holidays about a year ago. And we also have days where it's raining over the entire watershed, which would probably be indicative of most of this winter. All right. Important phone call. All right, so if we warm things up, if we just assume that, you know, the distribution stays about the same, but everything's a little bit warmer, we shift this up. About 2 degrees C warmer would shift up that rain snow line about 400 meters. This blue box is sort of the old range of wintry mix, and the red box would be the new range of wintry mix. So the new 0 degree sea level in the median goes all the way up to the top of the watershed. The new 3 degree sea level is about just under 1,000 meters. So in this case, 25% gets a wintry mix and 75% just gets runoff. So the watershed's worried. Right now, they have that upper part of the watershed is providing a reservoir that doesn't go and flood Rattlesnake Lake. It's keeping the water until the summer where we need it. So the goal is we don't need more water, we just want the water to stay, we just want the snow to stay on the ground longer. So what can we do to keep the snow on the ground to help increase our ability to manage the reservoir for both people and hydropower and bull trout? And here's just a picture. This is from the Climate Impacts Group Climate Assessment, which you can find online. Here's the Cedar River, and what you see is that it's in what they're calling a transition zone. Snow dominated are less sensitive. This is right in the most sensitive basins of the state as climate warms. And this is from a paper put together by Julie Vanno, who you heard speak this morning, just showing the red line here is historical stream flow in the Cedar River in two locations, and then the gray lines just show sort of the range of uncertainty as we go into the future, but we've got likely earlier runoff, less late season runoff is the shift you see here. All right, so we want to keep snow on the ground. Here's a picture looking up the Cedar Reservoir. You can sort of see here's the snow line up there. What goes on between trees and snow? What can we use to help us? The primary thing trees do is they intercept snow. We've all been up there, we've seen all the snow sticks to the trees. And then it's exposed more to the atmosphere from the top of the trees. And in a dry climate, that snow will sublimate, go back to the atmosphere, and be lost to the watershed. In our climate, where it tends to be pretty warm, most of that snow melts. So it actually drips. Drips down, but it ends up being earlier runoff. It doesn't stick if it's stuck in the trees. It melts earlier. There's been a lot of studies, primarily in the Fraser Experimental Watershed in Colorado, of snow interception, and it's shown that if you clear-cut forests, you end up with a lot more water. Another issue, though, is that if you get rid of all the forests, obviously you have no interception, so you get more snow, but trees also provide shade from the sun. So snow, once it gets to the ground, presuming it hasn't been intercepted, lasts longer if trees are around to protect it from the sun and the wind. So this is a diagram from a paper published by Jörg Jost working up in British Columbia forests. And the solid line are clear-cut forests. The dashed line is under a forest canopy. They went out at different times in April and May to two different sites. These have different aspects. One is north-facing, one is south-facing. But the thing to take away here is that early in the season, there is more snow in the clear cut at both sites. But if you go late in the season to late May, there is actually more snow left under the forest canopy. So a clear cut will give you more total water, but in this case, if your goal was we have enough water total, we just want to keep something on the ground later, the forest canopy actually helped. So the idea of our project is as your tree density goes from low to high, you have the melt effect where you have no trees that melts faster, you have lots of trees that melt slower. You have the interception effect where you have lots of trees, you have lots of interception, which means less snow to start with. You have low trees, and you have no interception if there's no trees. But you know, can we do something? Obviously, for issues of erosion and habitat diversity, we don't want to just clear cut all of our trees. We want to be somewhere in between. So you know, is there somewhere in the middle that might be optimal snow water storage for the watershed? So can we manage our forests to keep snow on the ground? So here's what we're doing. This is a very complicated model put together by Pascal Stork. It's the snow component that's in both of the models that were developed here at the University of Washington. So this is VIC, variable infiltration capacity, and DHSVM, which is sort of a small-scale version of VIC, distributed hydrologic simulation vegetation model. And what Pascal Stork did was he actually went down to Oregon and cut an entire tree and stuck it in a weighing lysimeter and said, you know, what's going on with the tree, with interception? How do we parameterize everything? And created this model that includes all kinds of processes for a tree, which has a whole bunch of different parameters, such as leaf area index, maximum interception, the albedo under the trees, the transmittance of light through the trees, lots of tunable parameters. The one issue with this, though, is that it's primarily, these models think about, you know, one giant tree for grid cell that's doing all this. And we know from going up in the forest that we have, you know, lots of different types of trees. We have, you know, managed forests, we have old growth forests, we have thin forests. You know, how can you take this one step further to actually represent what we're doing to the trees on the ground? So I started thinking about this and met with Jim Lutz and Charlie Halpern over at UW Forestry. And it turns out that we're already, before I got interested in this, working in the Cedar watershed on how do you actually treat forests, given that most of it's, you know, 80-year-old, very dense, what I showed you in that first plot. And they had set up these plots up here in the Cedar watershed to look at understory growth. And in doing so, they had mapped every single tree in the entire area and knew everything you could want to know. Well, everything I could want to know about the trees. I'm sure forest people want to know even more. All right. And this is a paper put together by Doug Sprugel et al. In ecological modeling. And here are, these are stem maps from the three different treatments they're looking at. Untreated, as I said, super dense. Gap creation, where they cut gaps. And a structured ecological thin, where they went and sort of, in a very organized, random manner, cut down trees. And then this is percent of above canopy light that makes it down. And I saw this as a snow scientist who got really excited and said, you know, this is no melt, this is where it's melting in the red zones. How can we actually, you know, take some of this structure and get it into our snow model to figure out what's happening? So we started the project in September, and these are Charlie's plots up there. We put out 5 weather stations, 10 snow depth sensors, which were kindly donated by Andres at the University of British Columbia, We've got 5 digital cameras. We've got a fiber optic cable going all the way down here, which actually can measure the temperature every centimeter, which was donated by Scott Tyler at the University of Nevada, Reno. And we have 50 ground temperature sensors. And then we have all these transects are where we had high hopes of going and actually measuring snow depth. I'm going to show you an example of this is last November, 15th, 16th, 17th. And one thing to note, we needed an old growth site. It's hard to find an old growth site. We couldn't co-locate it exactly with the treatment, so it's a little bit higher and it's a little bit colder. This is temperature at all the sites. And here are those 3 days going back to pictures I showed you at the beginning. So you can see on the 15th of November, we have snow at all the sites. This is the thinned clearing and control by the 16th. And you can see that the clearing has much more snow, no interception. The control, the densest, has much little. As it starts melting, you can see by the 17th, there's still snow left in the control, which has no trees. There's a clearing. That control has trees that we didn't touch. And there's no snow here. And even the thin, there's no snow. And just for a couple more, here's the gap. The gap still has snow left. And the old growth has very, very little snow left. So in this very brief experiment, the gap in the clearing won. And now if technology likes me, you can actually watch this event on the digital cameras in a movie. Technology may not like me. Let's see. No. It played on my computer, but sorry, you can't watch it. But we have movies. It's very cool. And the moral of the story is that given that that was essentially our snow event, and after December, we haven't had any snow since, we don't have any conclusive results. We'll be keep doing this for the next several years and hopefully get better snow winters. So perhaps trees can help us retain snow in the landscape, but we have to get some snow first. This is a picture of the penstocks from the hydropower plant up there, and these are all the students in my hydraulics class on a field trip. And thank you to many, many people who helped get all the stuff up there to measure the snow we don't have. I'll open it up to questions. Thank you. A lot of the early work done into, you know, let's get rid of the trees and maximize our water was done with comparing clear cuts versus trees, clear cuts versus untouched trees. That I think right now nobody really wants to clear cut because of the erosion and the whole watershed going down. What we're primarily talking about now is that, I mean, if you go and walk in these forests, if you walk in the old growth forest. It feels very park-like. It's very open. There's a lot of space between the trees. It's interesting. There's some like evolutionary response where I just feel very happy and comfortable in that forest. And when I walk into the 80-year-old forest that is regrown post-clearcut, what we have in most of our mountains right now, it is very dense. I mean, you're sort of like dodging trees. They're all exactly the same age. There's no light getting in there whatsoever. There's nothing growing on the bottom with no light. All of the snow is being intercepted. So right now we're saying, well, you know, what can we do to basically not clear cut it, but you know, cut gaps in it or thin it, or what can we do to try watershed forest, or what Rolf's interested in is, can we accelerate getting things more to a more natural state? And if we do that, will that help us? With the exception of the clearing, which was actually a big gap, because we didn't clear much. None of these are enough trees gone that you're going to really unstabilize the hill slope.
Have you measured the hydrologic response to all those treatments?
To these? These are too small to actually show up. If you, in terms of the hydrology of the watershed, if you go to our map here, you know, each one of these, this is 10 meters right here. So these are 40 meters by 40 meters. And we have essentially a strip we're looking at, but you know, roughly 400 meters. In terms of the entire watershed, if you do it just at these sites, you're not going to see it. You'd have to apply this over a much greater area, and then you're getting into cost as well. Can you afford to go cut gaps out of how much of your watershed? And they've actually, what the study by Georg Joss, where he was looking at it, he was looking at bark beetle impacts up in British Columbia and found that for the larger, and they basically lost huge sections up at the top, but it was only, in terms of where they had the river gauge, it was only about 15% of the total watershed. And at that level, the change of 15% wasn't enough to actually show up in hydrograph. You actually have to change 50% of what you're interested in. Yeah.
Are you accounting for any other landscape responses to the adaptation
and up in the Charlie Halpern's group is looking at understory growth. So they actually have a whole bunch of flags that I try not to step on that mark where the bryophytes are, and basically everything that's growing underneath. And they're finding that essentially doing any kind of treatment that brings more light in makes for healthier understory and increases biodiversity. And you can, I can see that from walking around there not even knowing any biology.
Thank you.